My poor darling. His lips formed the words without sound, and slowly the splendid mood of the previous night washed away like sand before the incoming tide of harsh reality. My poor, brave darling. He had not known grief like this since he stood beside his father's open grave. If only there was something I could do to help you, now, in this time of your need. And as he said it, the thought occurred to him, and he started so violently that Santaine felt it and rolled away from him in her sleep, frowning again, the corner of her eyelid twitching, and she muttered something that he could not understand and then was still. Blaine lay rigid beside her, every muscle in his body under stress, his fists clenched at his sides, his jaws biting down hard, appalled at himself, angry and frightened that he had been even capable of thinking that thought. His eyes were wide open now. He stared at the bright coin of sunlight on the opposite wall, but did not see it. For he was a man on the torturer's rack, the rack of a terrible temptation. Honour. The words blazed in his mind. Honour and duty. He groaned silently, as on the other side of his brain, another word burned as fiercely. Love. The woman who lay beside him had set no price upon her love. She had made no terms, no bargains, but had simply given without asking in return. Rather than demanding, she had given him quittance. It was she who had insisted that no other person should be hurt by their happiness. Freely, she had heaped upon him all the sweets of her love without asking the smallest price. Not the gold band and vows of marriage, not even promises or assurances. And he had offered nothing. Until this moment, there had been nothing for him to give her in repayment. On the other hand, he had been singled out by a great and good man who had placed unquestioning trust in him. Honour and duty on one hand, love on the other. This time there was no escape from the lash of his conscience. Who would he betray? The man he revered or the woman he loved? He could not lie still another moment, and stealthily he lifted the sheet. Santaine's eyelids fluttered. She made a little mewling sound and then settled deeper into sleep. The previous evening she had laid out a new razor and toothbrush on the washstand in the bathroom for him, and this little thoughtfulness goaded him further. The agony of indecision scourged him as he shaved and dressed. He tiptoed back into the bedroom and stood beside the bed. I could walk away, he thought. She will never know of my treachery. And then he wondered at his choice of word. Was it treachery to keep intact his honour, to cleave to his duty? He forced the thought aside and made his decision. He reached down and touched her eyelids. They fluttered open. She looked up at him, her pupils very black and big and unfocused. Then they contracted and she smiled. A comfortable, sleepy, contented smile. Darling, she murmured, what time is it? Santaine, are you awake? She sat up quickly and exclaimed with dismay, Oh, Blaine, you are dressed so soon. Listen to me, Santaine. This is very important. Are you listening? She nodded, blinking the last vestiges of sleep from her eyes, and stared at him solemnly. Santaine, we are going off gold, he said, and his voice was harsh, rough with self-contempt and guilt. They made the decision yesterday, Ubas and Barry Herzog. We'll be off gold by the time the markets reopen in the new year. She stared at him blankly for a full 5 seconds, and then suddenly it struck her, and her eyes flared wide open. but then slowly the fire in them faded again. "Oh, my God, my darling, what must it have cost you to tell me that?" she said. And her voice shook with compassion, for she understood his sense of honour and knew the depths of his duty. "You do love me, Blaine. You do truly love me. I believe it now." Yet he was glaring at her. She had never seen such an expression on his face before. It was almost as though he hated her for what he had done. She couldn't bear that look, and she scrambled onto her knees in the centre of the rumpled bed and held out her arms in appeal. "Blaine, I won't use it. I won't use what you have told me." And he snarled at her, his face contorted with guilt. "That way, you would let me make this sacrifice for naught." "Don't hate me for it, Blaine," she pleaded, and the anger faded from his face. "Hate you?" he asked sadly. "No, Santaine, that I could never do." She wanted to run after him, to try and comfort him, but she knew that it was beyond even the power of her great love. She sensed that, like a wounded lion, he had to be alone. And she listened to his heavy footfalls receding down the path through the plantation outside her window. Santaine sat at her desk at Veldhoven. She was alone. And in the centre of her desk stood the ivory and brass telephone. She was afraid. What she was about to do would place her far beyond the laws of society and the courts. She was at the beginning of a journey into uncharted territory, a lonely, dangerous journey, which could end for her in disgrace and imprisonment. The telephone rang, and she started, and stared at the instrument fearfully. It rang again, and she drew a deep breath and lifted the handset. "Your call to Rabkin and Swales, Mrs. Courtney," her secretary told her. "I have Mr. Swales on the line." "Thank you, Nigel." She heard the hollow tone of her voice and cleared her throat. "Mrs. Courtney," she recognized Swales's voice. He was the senior partner in the firm of stockbrokers, and she had dealt with him before. "May I wish you the compliments of the festive season," he said. "Thank you, Mr. Swales." Her voice was crisp and businesslike. "I have a buying order for you, Mr. Swales. I'd like it filled before the market closes today." "Of course," Swales assured her. "We will complete it immediately. Please buy, at best, 500,000 East Rand proprietary mines," she said. And there was an echoing silence in the earphones. 500,000, Mrs. Courtney," Swales repeated at last. "ERPM are standing at 22 and 6. That is almost £600,000. "Exactly," Santaine agreed. "Mrs. Courtney," Swales stopped. "Is there some problem, Mr. Swales?" No, of course not. None at all. You caught me by surprise, that's all. Just the size of the order. I will get on to it right away. I will post you my check in full settlement just as soon as I receive your contract note for the purchase." She paused, and then went on icily. "Unless, of course, you require me to send you a deposit immediately." She held her breath. Nowhere could she raise even the deposit that Swales was entitled to ask for. "Oh, dear Mrs. Courtney, I hope you didn't think... I must sincerely apologize for having led you to think that I might question your ability to pay. There is absolutely no hurry. We will post you the contract note in the usual way. Your credit with Rabkin and Swales is always good. I hope to confirm the purchase for you by tomorrow morning at the very latest. As you are no doubt aware, tomorrow is the final trading day before the Christmas recess." Her hands were shaking so violently that she had trouble setting the handset of the telephone on its hook. "What have I done?" she whispered. And she knew the answer. She had committed a criminal act of fraud, the maximum penalty for which was 10 years imprisonment. She had just contracted a debt which she had no reasonable expectation of honouring. She was bankrupt. She knew she was bankrupt. And she had just taken on another £500,000 obligation. She was taken with a fit of remorse, and she reached for the telephone to cancel the order, but it rang before she touched it. "Mrs. Courtney, I have Mr. Anderson of Hawkes and Giles on the line." "Put him on, please, Nigel," she ordered. And she was amazed that there was no tremor in her voice as she said casually, "Mr. Anderson, I have a purchase order for you, please." By noon, she had telephoned 7 separate firms of stockbrokers in Johannesburg and placed orders for the purchase of gold mining shares to the value of £5.5 million. Then at last her nerve failed her. "Nigel, cancel the other 2 calls, please," she said calmly, and ran to her private bathroom at the end of the passage, with her hands over her mouth. Just in time, she fell to her knees in front of the white porcelain toilet bowl and vomited into it a hard projectile stream, bringing up her terror and shame and guilt, heaving and retching until her stomach was empty and the muscles of her chest ached and her throat burned as though it had been scalded raw with acid. Christmas Day had always been one of their very special days since Shasta was a child, but she awoke this morning in a somber mood. Still in their night clothes and dressing gowns, she and Shasta exchanged their presents in her suite. He had hand-painted a special card for her and decorated it with pressed wild flowers. His present to her was François Mauriac's new novel, Nuit de Vipère, and he had inscribed on the flyleaf, "No matter what, we still have each other, Shasta." Her present to him was a leather flying helmet with goggles, and he looked at her with amazement. She had made her opposition to flying very plain. "Yes, Cherie, if you want to learn to fly, I'll not stop you." "Can we afford it, Mater? I mean, you know..." "You let me worry about that," she said. "No, Mater." He shook his head firmly. "I'm not a child anymore. From now on, I'm going to help you. I don't want anything that will make it more difficult for you. For us." She ran to him and embraced him quickly, pressing her cheek to his so that he could not see the shine of tears in her eyes. "We are desert creatures. We will survive, my darling." But her moods swung wildly all the rest of that day, as Santaine played the Grande Dame, the Chatelaine of Veldhoven, welcoming the many callers at the estate, serving sherry and biscuits and exchanging gifts with them, laughing and charming, and then, on the pretext of seeing to the servants, hurrying away to lock herself in the mirrored study with the drawn curtains, while she fought off the black moods, the doubts, and the terrible crippling forebodings. Shasta seemed to understand, standing in her place when she fell out, suddenly mature and responsible, rallying to her aid, as he had never been called upon to do before. Just before noon, one of their callers brought tidings which genuinely allowed Santaine to forget, for a short time, her own forebodings. The Reverend Canon Burt was the headmaster of bishops, and he took Santaine and Shasta aside for a few moments. "Mrs. Courtney, you know what a name young Shasta has made for himself at Bishop's," Unfortunately, next year will be his last with us. We shall miss him. However, I am sure it will come as no surprise to you to hear that I have selected him to be head of school in the new term, or that the Board of Governors has endorsed my choice.
Not in front of the head, Mater, Shasta whispered in an agony of embarrassment when Santane embraced him joyously.
But she deliberately kissed both his cheeks in the manner he designated French, and pretend to disparage.
That is not all, Mrs. Courtney. Canon Burt beamed on this display of maternal pride.
I have been asked by the Board of Governors to invite you to join them. You will be the first woman, the first lady, ever to sit on the board.
Santane was on the point of accepting immediately, but then, like the shadow of the executioner's axe, the premonition of impending financial catastrophe dulled her vision, and she hesitated.
I know you are a very busy person, he was about to urge her. I am honored, Headmaster, she told him, but there are personal considerations. May I give you my reply in the new year?
Well, just as long as that is not an outright refusal.
No, I give you my assurance. If I can, I will.
When the last caller had been packed off, Santane could lead the family, including Sir Gary and Anna and the very closest family friends, down to the polo field for the next act in their traditional Belt of Raiden Christmas festival. The entire coloured staff was assembled there, with their children and aged parents, and the estate pensioners too old to work, and all the others who Santane supported. Every one of them was dressed in their Sunday best, a marvellous assortment of styles and cuts and colours, the little girls with ribbons in their hair, and the small boys, for once with shoes on their feet. The estate band, fiddles and concertinas and banjos, welcomed Santane, and the singing, the very voice of Africa, was melodious and beautiful. She had a gift for each of them, which she handed over with an envelope containing their Christmas bonus. Some of the older women, emboldened by their long service and sense of occasion, embraced her. And so precarious was Santane's mood that these spontaneous gestures of affection made her weep again, which set the other women off. It was swiftly becoming an orgy of sentiment, and Shasta hastily signaled the band to strike up something lively. They chose Alabama, the old Cape Malay song that commemorated the cruise of the Confederate raider to Cape Waters when she captured the Sea Bride in Table Bay on the 5th of August, 1863. There comes the Alabama. Dar kom de Alabama. Then Shasta supervised the drawing of the bung from the first keg of sweet estate wine, and almost immediately the tears dried and the mood became festive and gay. Once the whole sheep on the spits was sizzling and dripping rich fat onto the coals, the second keg of wine had been broached. The dancing was losing all restraint, and the younger couples were sneaking away into the vineyards. And then Santane gathered the party from the big house and left them to it. As they passed the Huguenot vineyard, they heard the giggling and scuffling amongst the vines behind the stone wall. And Sir Gary remarked complacently, "Shouldn't think Belt of Raiden is going to run short of labour in the foreseeable future. Sounds like a good crop being planted."
"You are as shameless as they are," Anna huffed, and then giggled herself, just as breathlessly as the young girls in the vineyard, as he squeezed her thick waist and whispered something into her ear.
That little intimacy lanced Santane with a blade of loneliness, and she thought of Blaine and wanted to weep again. But Shasta seemed to sense her pain and took her hand and made her laugh with one of his silly jokes. The family dinner was part of the tradition. Before they ate,
Chasse read aloud to them from the New Testament, as he had every Christmas day since his 6th birthday. Then he and Santaine distributed the pile of presents from under the tree, and the salon was filled with a rustle of paper and the oohs and ahs of delight. The dinner was roast turkeys and a baron of beef, followed by a rich black Christmas pudding. Chasse found the lucky gold sovereign in his portion, as he did every year without suspecting that it had been carefully salted there by Santaine during the serving. And when, at the end, they all tottered away, satiated and heavy-eyed, to their separate bedrooms, Santaine slipped out of the French windows of her study and ran all the way down through the plantation and burst into the cottage. Blaine was waiting for her, and she ran to him. "We should be together at Christmas and every other day," she said. He stopped her from going on by kissing her, and she reviled herself for her silliness. When she pulled back in his arms, she was smiling brightly. "I couldn't wrap your Christmas present. The shape is all wrong, and the ribbon wouldn't stay on. You'll have to take it au naturel." "Where is it?" he asked. "Follow me, sir, and it shall be delivered unto you." "Now that," he said a little later, "is by far the nicest present that anybody ever gave me, and so very useful, too." There were no newspapers on New Year's Day, but Santaine listened to the news every hour on the radio. There was no mention of the gold standard or any other political issue on these bulletins. Blaine was away, occupied all day with meetings and discussions concerning his candidature for the coming parliamentary by-election at the Gardens. Chasse had gone as house guest to one of the neighbouring estates. She was alone with her fears and doubts. She read until after midnight, and then lay in the darkness, sleeping only fitfully and plagued by nightmares, starting awake and then drifting back into uneasy sleep. Long before dawn, she gave up the attempt to find rest, and dressed in yodpas and riding boots and her sheepskin coat. She saddled her favourite stallion and rode down in the darkness 5 miles to the railway station at Claremont to meet the early train from Cape Town. She was waiting on the platform when the bundles of newspapers were thrown out of the goods van onto the concrete quay, and the small coloured newsboys swarmed over them, chattering and laughing as they divided up the bundles for delivery. Santaine tossed one of them a silver shilling, and he hooted with glee when she waved away the change and eagerly unfolded the newspaper. The headlines took up fully half the front page, and they rocked her on her feet. "South Africa abandons gold standard. Huge boost for gold mines." She scanned the columns below, barely able to take in any more, and then, still in a daze, rode back up the valley to Veldhoven. Only when she reached the Onreath gates did the full impact of it all dawn upon her. Veldhoven was still hers. It would always be hers. And she rose in the stirrups and shouted with joy, then urged her horse into a flying gallop, lifting him over the stone wall and racing down between the rows of vines. She left him in his stall and ran all the way back to the chateau. She had to talk to someone. If only it could have been Blaine. But Sir Gary was in the dining room. He was always first down for breakfast. "Have you heard the news, my dear?" he cried excitedly the moment she entered. "I heard it on the radio at 6 o'clock. We are off gold. Herzog did it. By God, there will be a few fortunes made and lost this day. Anybody who is holding gold shares will double and treble their money." "Oh, my dear, is something wrong?" Santaine had collapsed into her chair at the head of the dining room table. "No, no." She shook her head frantically. "There is nothing wrong. Not any more. Everything is all right. Wonderfully, magnificently, stupendously, all right.
At lunchtime, Blaine telephoned her at Veldhoven Raden. He had never done so before. His voice sounded hollow and strange on the scratchy line. He did not announce himself, but said simply, 5 o'clock at the cottage.
Yes, I'll be there.
She wanted to say more, but the line clicked dead. She went down to the cottage an hour early, with fresh flowers, clean, crisply ironed linen for the bed, and a bottle of Bollinger champagne, and she was waiting for him when he walked into the living room. "There are no words that can adequately express my gratitude," she said. "That is the way I want it, Santaine," he told her seriously. "No words. We will never talk about it again. I shall try to convince myself it never happened. Please promise me never to mention it. Never again as long as we live and love each other." "I give you my solemn word," she said. And then all her relief and joy came bubbling up, and she kissed him, laughing. "Won't you open the champagne?" And she raised the brimming glass when he handed it to her, and gave him his own words back as a toast. "For as long as we live and love each other, my darling." The Johannesburg Stock Exchange reopened on January the 2nd, and in the first hour very little business could be conducted, for the floor was like a battlefield, as the brokers literally tore at each other, screaming for attention. But by call-over, the market had shaken itself out and settled at its new levels. Swales, of Rabkin and Swales, was the first of her brokers to telephone Santaine. Like the market, his tone was buoyant and effervescent. "My dear Mrs. Courtney," in the circumstances Santaine was prepared to let that familiarity pass, "my very dear Mrs. Courtney, your timing has been almost miraculous. As you know, we were unfortunately unable to fill your entire purchase order. We were able to obtain only 440,000 ERPMs at an average price of 25 shillings. The volume of your order pushed the price up 2 and 6. However," she could almost hear him puffing himself up to make his announcement, "however, I am delighted to be able to tell you that this morning ERPMs are trading at 55 shillings and still rising. I am looking forward to 60 shillings by the end of the week.